all these people. Was that a
platinum? Come on. Is that lightning or something vicious?
So it's like landing.
Picture.
Coming in.
That's okay. Dissidents in the bushes.
Harriet was walking up the thing like this and he just went.
Yeah.
Shot a picture on this. Marcus. Beginning a section on translations. There are numerous translations out. Christian bookstore stock, upwards of 10, 15, 20. A person browsed around, it could come up with 30 or 40. And I've browsed around and come up with some 80. But not everybody would get that diligent at it. There are guides to translations. Most of these guides I disagree with on a number of points. I found that books written about translations seem to praise Living and Good News and these other translations, emphasizing the understandability of the translation and praising that, instead of emphasizing the accuracy of the translation to the Greek or Hebrew. And in their minds, it's far more important to produce something that people can understand. And so we differ on our method of evaluation. There are a number of types of translations. There are committee translations and there are individual translations. Individual translations have the ability of being brilliant, mediocre, or very poor. Committee translations are almost always a compromise. And while they can never be really brilliant, they can never really be that poor either. Because usually there's somebody on the committee voting for something good. Then there are different types of translations. By the way, the King James, ERV, ASV, NIV, NAS, those are all committee translations. And consequently, they are compromise translations. I don't mean that in a negative way. They're balanced translations. Anybody wanting a particularly erratic translation would be overruled by the rest of the committee. And of course, somebody wanting something very literal in an obscure passage that everybody else doesn't see, they're going to overrule that as well. These translations have their strength in their evenness. They're not all over the map. They're fairly even. That is to say, the accuracy in Mark is probably about as good as in Revelation. And the accuracy in Mark 5:7 is probably about as good as in Revelation 3:2. Whereas some of the other translations can be inaccurate in one spot and accurate in another. Now, the King James does have literal portions in it, and it does have paraphrases in it. So, in a sense, it even contradicts what I just said. But overall, being a committee translation, it's fairly even. Now, types of translation, one common type is a literal translation. Rotherham is a literal translation. Young's is a literal translation. Concordant is an extremely literal translation. There are a number of translations that claim to be literal, but I don't believe they are. At least they wouldn't. They're not literal in the sense of a Rotherham. They say literal, but what they probably mean something a little bit different than that. Others have called this a formal equivalence. Formal equivalence. Now, as a translation, they're talking about something equal or equivalent. And by the word formal, they mean they mean literal. A second type of translation is idiomatic, with the word idiom in it, I-D-I-O-M. Idiom, idiomatic. Of course, an idiom is a peculiar way of saying something that is understandable at a given time. There are idioms that we have. There are Hebrew idioms. An idiomatic translation is called a dynamic equivalent or dynamic equivalence. That is, they translate the meanings. Translate the meanings. Now, idiomatic translations are NIV, Berkeley, Weymouth. Good News is said to be an idiomatic translation, but we might debate and say it's more of a paraphrase, since it's more of an extreme in this category. Of course, within the literal camp, we have the most literal and the least literal, so to speak. In the idiomatic camp, we have those that are somewhat even literal, but they're still claimed to be idiomatic. And then there are those that are extremely idiomatic, and they're really paraphrases, maybe drop down into that category. Now, there's a difference between formal equivalence, literal, and dynamic equivalence, idiomatic. There's a difference between translating the words and translating the equivalent meaning. Translating the meaning. Now, there's a passage in Greek where the 5,000 sat down. The King James says they sat down in ranks or something like that. They sat down in groups of 50. The literal is they sat down like beds in a garden. Now, the King James chose to translate that as a dynamic equivalent. They chose to translate the thought or idea. They did not translate it, they sat down like beds in a garden, because we don't have that particular expression, although we could probably guess what they meant. We have particular expressions in English that mean, sometimes they mean the opposite of what they literally mean. And especially when you get into slang. Slang has a lot of strange meanings. We talk about take the road back to town, catch the bus. These type of things would have to be idiomatically translated if you were going to translate them into some dialect in Bolivia or something. Catch the bus, they would wonder what in the world that meant. And so there is a need for an idiomatic translation. You can't always be literal everywhere. But it's up to the translator to make a decision when to be literal and when to translate the meaning. And of course, an NIV translation has chosen to emphasize the meanings, although they get literal at times, but they've chosen to emphasize the meanings. Rotherham has chosen to emphasize the word for word, literal. And he'll even sacrifice understanding at times There are some verses in Colossians that don't even make a lick of sense, at least to somebody who's not acquainted with the Scriptures and can make sense out of it. Now, you could understand it, and I can understand it. Somebody else, it's written very awkwardly to the average. It'd never be read like a newspaper in English. Some have wanted to translate the New Testament and make it read like the Times, or make it read like just something every day that we would read. And in recognizing that the New Testament was written in everyday Greek, they've tried to translate it into everyday English. I'm not 100% against that. I think there's times for that. But oftentimes, in translating it into everyday English, they come up with all kinds of slang expressions that aren't even everyday and get outdated. Phillips translation, which is a paraphrase, is our third category. Phillips talks about Paul not taking payment of anyone, and he says, "I sponged on no one." Well, sponged is a particular idiom that means, you know, take money from or take a handout. And, you know, you took that literally, you'd come up with something completely different. Phillips is loaded with slang. Living Bible is a paraphrase. This is an attempt to translate the entire thought or rephrase or paraphrase the thoughts and ideas of the Scripture. Of course, a paraphrase is going to contain what the author thinks, what the translator thinks Paul or Christ or Peter is saying. It will involve theological bias. It will involve his understanding of the thoughts. It can be taken a number of ways, and he'll have to come down and choose a way. Living Bible, for example, translates Melchizedek, "He never lived, he never died." Instead of bringing out the type without father or mother, he says he never lived. Oh, it says he was never born and never died. He lived. He was never born and never died. And then Living Bible in Genesis says that evil spirits came down and had sexual intercourse with men and produced giants. Taking that, you know, the sons of God saw the sons of, what does it say? Daughters of men, well, they had that sons of God as evil spirits coming down. Well, that is obviously a doctrinal thought of the translator, paraphrasing it for you. Of course, if you don't agree with that, you obviously are going to have trouble with that rendering. A fourth type of translation, expanded translation. By the way, the paraphrase translation does have a purpose. There is a use for it. Believe it or not, there are times when I have consulted a paraphrase just to see how a certain thing is said. Not so that I could understand what was said, but so that I might have some way of describing it or amplifying it to others as I taught it. Because basically, when you get up and teach, you're either going to be expanding, interpreting, paraphrasing, you're going to be doing all that. I won't call it a translation, that's for sure. I call it an exposition. The expanded translation, amplified, is the only one of the whole Bible. Kenneth Wiest of the New Testament and F.F. Bruce of the Epistles of Paul. An expanded translation seeks to bring out the fullness and richness of the Greek. Often, the amplified has just added a bunch of words that they find in the Greek concordance. For example, Jesus said to the demon, "Be silent, come out of him." They have, "Be silent, muzzled, gagged, come out of him." In other words, all they did was look up the Greek word for "be silent," and they saw in the concordance "muzzled, gagged, and silent," and so they just took the whole thing and plugged it in. They expanded that Greek word to include maybe other things that it could mean in another context. Expanded translations, particularly Wiest. Wiest is a Greek teacher and has a number of good renderings. Can be very helpful to somebody wanting to expand or understand a passage. especially in explaining it or teaching it. And in reference to this particular move of God, I have found reading Wiest in the New Testament particularly edifying, because he expands and brings out certain passages on dying to self and on coming to the cross and on love and other things. And boy, they really hit home. It's almost like reading it new. Wiest is a real blessing. Amplified has some benefits as well. A fifth category is a simplified New Testament. A simplified New Testament is different than a paraphrase. A paraphrase seeks to rephrase so that you'll understand it. A simplified is usually written with a limited vocabulary so as to make the reading of it understandable to those with limited English background or children. A study was done on the English language, and it was determined that in selecting 1,000 words, almost anything could be described in the English language. Any particular word could be defined using this 1,000 words. Thereby, you could communicate the thought of that big word. Locomotive. Large mechanical thing going down the rails. I mean, they could redefine it. Of course, mechanical would be a word they wouldn't have in their 1,000 either. But mechanical, they could break that down into a machine. They could break that down into moving parts producing something. I mean, they redefine all these words. And they have actually translated the New Testament with this limited vocabulary. One translation sought to translate the New Testament using only 1,000 English vocabulary words. They did have to add a few Bible words that were peculiar to the New Testament, figuring that it would be better to leave them in than to define them. Perhaps something like baptism or something like that. Oftentimes, the limited vocabulary has a very limited sentence structure as well. Jesus came, period. He said this, period. Then this happened, period. I mean, they've got these little tiny short sentences. And in the Pauline epistles, where Paul's got all these dependent and independent clauses running in a big string, they've got all that chopped up into just nice little neat sentences. It's like see Spot run, see Spot, see Jane, here comes Jane, Jane loves Spot. I mean, you got all this kind of thing going. These limited vocabulary were designed for people of low education or people who speak limited English. They're of particular value on the mission field. They're used a lot in foreign countries where oftentimes people have a smattering of English, but not good enough to read a real translation. And so these have been very useful in communicating the truth of the gospel and God's word. Limited vocabulary translations, the Bible in basic English. There's a translation, the New Life Testament, by Ledyard. The New Life Testament is the same as the Children's New Testament. On one of these, the Children's New Testament, they did a study. The Children's New Testament read at a third grade level. The NIV read at a seventh grade level. The NAS read at a 12th grade level. And I'm sure the King James reads at a 12th grade level. Showing the difference between NAS and NIV, and then NIV and the Children's New Testament. And we use that Children's New Testament in our Christian school. It's a fairly good translation. We also use NIV. NIV is a good one as well. Then another category of translations. This is versions with a slant or bias. This is a peculiar category. Versions with a slant or bias. And these are usually either literal or idiomatic. But because of their own peculiarities, I don't group them in those other categories. Now, in a mild way, the Roman Catholic versions could fall in this category, but only in a mild way. They hardly change anything. But New World Translation is in this category. Actually, New World is a very literal translation. But it has a definite bias. No question about it. Also, there is a Bible put out by Joseph Smith. New translation. Very heavy bias in it. There is a Christian Science New Testament out with a Christian Science emphasis. God is translated, God idea, that type of thing. It reads a lot like metaphysical writings. These are translations with a bias or a slant. Then another category. And this overlaps, perhaps idiomatic and literal, but there are a number of translations that are revisions of the King James. They're revisions of the King James. And they're really in their own peculiar category. Their purpose is not to communicate the New Testament in an idiomatic way or in a literal way. Their purpose is to revise the King James. That's the only reason they exist, is because somebody felt the King James needed a revision, and that they, and usually this is a group of people now, were qualified to do so. King James revisions are the ERV, the ASV, NAS, although I might put NAS over in literal camp, but it is really a revision. It's a revision of the ASV, but it's a revision of the King James when you get back to it. It strives to be both, and it might have a good balance. It might have a good balance.
Did they translate that from NASB?
Yeah.
King James came from totally different.
Oh, right.
TR.
Right. See, the ERV comes from a different text, too. That was part of the revision,
so
updating the text.
The goal is to revise the King James.
To update the King James, both in the text and in the translation. There wouldn't be an NAS if there wasn't a King James. Let's see. Go ahead.
Do you know anything about that translation called the Book? Yeah, I've seen some advertising on it. Is that just the Living Bible or the New Testament? It is.
Yeah, I think it is. Living Bible has come out in dozens of different editions, shapes, sizes. Advertised on television. I mean, it's really sold numerous copies. In fact, the Living Bible has basically launched Kenneth Taylor into the publishing business and given him a very large publishing company in America. So he tried to sell that thing to Moody, and they and a number of other publishers, so he published it himself, and now he rivals them. So,
what are the translations that translate God as a yet, you know, where there's, you know, anti-feminist, sexist Bible, what do they call them?
Well, there's only one of those, and it's going to be a revision of the RSV, and I don't think it's ever been put out that I know of.
It's
still... Is it out?
Yeah, it's out now.
Oh.
They have it over at Bellevue Community College. It's called Neuter Bible.
Well, we'll have to get a copy for the library for next semester, and we'll take a glance at it.
Oh, boy.
I would put that under category of versions with a slant or bias.
Yeah, right.
Because the whole purpose of it is to accomplish a certain thing, and so... Wouldn't fit in any other category. RSV is a revision of the King James. It's a revision of the ASV, but it's a revision of the King James when you get back to it. Well, Rotherham is a revision of the King James. He didn't even think of the King James. His purpose is to produce a real, literal, accurate translation. And there's a lot of translations in that category. Now, Kenneth Taylor, his idea was to paraphrase the King James to make it understandable to his kids, but I wouldn't call that a revision. That's a whole different thing. So, and there's overlap in these categories. That's granted. Go ahead.
Did he know some Greek and Hebrew when he translated?
Well, supposedly he did, and I notice in his text, he textually differs from the King James text. But I think he's come out and said that he used the King James and not Greek and Hebrew.
Is one of the Bible societies distributing that, or are they responsible for getting it out?
Living Bible is privately published, sold as a moneymaker. Most of the Bible societies do not make a profit. They're non-profit, and they don't make a profit on the books they sell. Now, they do make a profit, but it's not near what Moody and Tyndale and Kregel and all those guys make.
They're written versions that are incredibly cheap.
Well, they practically give good news away.
They didn't close 50 cents for postage.
Yeah, the Bible societies are not designed as a financial enterprise, but the Christian booksellers are. They're designed to make money, sell books at a profit.
Doesn't ABS or UBS put out a paraphrased version?
Yeah, good news. That's their modern speech or paraphrase. Christianity Today says, in this century, the demand for a more appropriate Bible in contemporary English has so far produced over 75 translations. Just to replace or to update or to accomplish something that the King James is failing in. Bible translating is actively being carried on by Wycliffe Bible translators all over the world. This was started in 1934. In 1942, they started to receive public funds. There are at least 500 languages in South America and 50 in Mexico alone. You didn't know there were 50 languages in Mexico. According to the latest figures, there are at least 3,000 groups of people who still wait for the scriptures in their own language. In 1983, the 200th New Testament completed, and with work going on in nearly 800 more. Before 1800, only 67 language groups had received any portion of the Bible in their native tongue. By 1900, it was 523. Now, it's estimated that the entire Bible is in 250 languages, the New Testament in 500, and portions of the Bible in 1,000. Wycliffe Bible translators are now working on 750 languages in 40 countries. They enter a new language group every 8 days. And in spite of the availability of scriptures in over 1,700 languages, not full but partial, the Bible is still a closed book for speakers of more than half the world's languages. This is a minority of the population, though. But over half the world's languages do not have the scripture in them. Now, a lot of these are obscure tribes and that kind of thing, but there's a group devoted just to the translation of scriptures to them. They were hoping to have this licked by the time the 80s ended, but, this is a task, so I doubt if they'll accomplish it by the year 2000. Go ahead.
Do you want to get more information on it?
Write the Wycliffe Bible translators. I'm sure you can get their address around somewhere. History of our English Bible reaches back to Greek and Hebrew. But after that, an important milestone was the Latin Vulgate, dated 404 A.D. 404 A.D. Vulgate means current or standardly used text. Current or standardly used text. Now, there are a number of Latin translations. Several dozen. In 1546, the translation done by Jerome in 404 was adopted as the official Catholic translation. It then became called the Vulgate. Now, it was called that before because it was the more popular Latin version. Just like in English, we have the authorized version. Authorized. Well, it's the most popular translation. And so the Latin Vulgate became chosen by the Roman Church as the official Latin version of the Church. Now, the Latin version was translated in probably the 2nd century AD. maybe even at the end of the first. The nature of Christianity is to spread the message. And you know that as the manuscripts were spread, translations were being made to other languages, and as the apostles went out and the gospel spread throughout the Roman Empire, it was a short time before translations were made. Now, at the close of the 4th century, they had a problem with many different Latin manuscripts, and there were a lot of variants in the Latin version. And a decision was going to be made to begin a study of textual criticism to synchronize all the Latin versions. But there was something else that could be done that would bypass all of that, and that would be to translate it all over again. Translate it accurately and carefully all over again, and dismiss all the versions, manuscripts of the Latin version. And why worry about all those variants? Who cares what the original Latin version is? And there are probably several versions, and that seemed like a waste of time. Jerome was chosen to translate the Bible into Latin. Jerome did not even know Hebrew when he was chosen. He spent 14 years and learned Hebrew and then translated it. No problem for these monks that are used to toiling 10 and 12 hours a day studying. You just sit down for 2 years and learn Hebrew, 10 or 12 hours a day, and you translate for the next 10 years. Or maybe it was 10 years learning it and translating it too. I don't know. Jerome knew that many would disapprove of his new Latin translation. Just like changes from the King James, very unpopular. He completed his translation in 404. It's a good conservative translation. He departed from some familiar Latin phrases, however. He was accused of shaking the foundation of the faith. However, he replied, "I could afford to despise these two-legged donkeys if I stood upon my rights. A liar is played in vain to an ass. If they do not like the water from the pure fountainhead, let them drink from the muddy streams." Well, Jerome wasn't delivered. But his Latin translation has had a great impact on the Bible. Perhaps the next major event is the translation of Jerome's Latin Vulgate into English by John Wycliffe, called the Wycliffe Bible. I have a copy of it, not an original, mind you, but every now and then somebody will put one of these out, and for a song you can land one. The Wycliffe Bible dates 1382. I've seen it dated 1380. I don't know which is right. Wycliffe is called the morning star of the Reformation. He was an eminent scholar, a diplomatist, and a preacher. Now, in 1229 AD, the Council of Toulouse passed 45 canons for the extinction of heresy. The first canon forbade the scriptures to the laity. It forbade any translation of the Holy Scriptures to be translated in the vulgar tongue, the native tongue of any peoples. They also said, quote, "We forbid the laity to possess any of the books of the Old or New Testament, except perhaps the Psalter," meaning the Psalms, "or the Hours of the Blessed Virgin, which some out of devotion wish to have. But having any of these books translated into their native tongue, we strictly forbid." Now, that was the mood of the Catholic Church in 1229. It had not really changed in 1382. Wycliffe sought to reform the Church and to bring the truth to the people bound in darkness. He saw that without the Scripture in English, no possible reformation could get off the ground. Remember, there was no printing press. So this is all going to be hand-translated and hand-copied, and any books made are all going to be by hand. You can see why John Wycliffe didn't launch any Reformation. There was the need of the printing press. There was a need of political climate that Luther capitalized on. There was a need of a combination of events in Europe to be able for Europe to stand up to the Pope and provide protection for Luther that he might preach and carry on this thing and others. When Wycliffe put out his translation, the papal authorities issued this statement: Master Wycliffe, by translating the gospel into English, hath rendered it more acceptable and more intelligent to laymen and women than it hath hitherto been to learned and intelligent clerks. The gospel pearl is everywhere cast out and trodden under foot of swine. Now that's how the Catholics look at the Catholic laity. They call them swine. And that the truth of the message of the gospel in their tongue would be treated as pearls cast to swine. It is heresy to speak of the Holy Scriptures in English. Let the people learn to believe in the church rather than the gospel. Then the archbishop wrote, that pestilent wretch, John Wycliffe, the son of the old serpent, the forerunner of the Antichrist, who hath completed his iniquity by inventing a new translation of the Scriptures. Now in 1360, Wycliffe began to publicly expose the Romish system through preaching, teaching, and tracts. They did not like the tracts. The last 15 years of his life, he was censored. Then he was brought to trial. But events occurred each time he was brought to trial, allowing him to escape. He was ordered imprisoned at one time, but he stood in high favor with many in Parliament, and he was powerfully protected by John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster. He was summoned to trial at St. Paul's, but a riot ensued and broke that up. A later council failed to reach a decision, and the Queen intervened and saved his life. He died of old age, I reckon, or he did not die of martyrdom, and perhaps something else. His Bibles were sought out and burned, and 170 of them are left today. 13 years after he is dead, the Catholics dug up his bones and burned them. But I doubt if it affected John at all. His Bible made an impact on England, but not a major impact. Not a major impact. It did carry a certain amount of revival that he brought as a reformer and as a preacher of truth, but it lacked the combination of events that Luther got when he was able to launch the complete an overwhelming Reformation that actually broke out of the church. The next translation is William Tyndale's translation. Now, translations had already occurred in Italy, French, Dutch, German, Bohemian. The Hebrew Old Testament was first published in 1488. Erasmus's Greek Testament was first published in 1516. And so Tyndale was able to take advantage of these two things, plus there being a printing press, and that thing having got off the ground for financial reasons. It was a real boon. In 1525, Tyndale finished his New Testament and published it. Tyndale revised it in 1534. Tyndale studied Greek and Hebrew and was a good scholar. He used Erasmus's Greek text. He published the New Testament and he translated a large portion of the Old Testament before he was imprisoned. Tyndale was strangled and burned at the stake, never completing the Old Testament. Tyndale's translation was condemned. Tyndale recognized that he could not print the Bible in England. Pressure from the Catholic Church and fear, there's not a printer in the land who would touch it with a 10-foot pole. So he went to Germany. In Germany, he was discovered and he had to escape. This thing was carried on underground. The thing was published outside of England, and then it began to be smuggled into England. King Henry VIII of fame heard in advance and ordered watches at all the roads, and people were searched and wagons were opened. Bibles were confiscated and burned. Of the first 18,000, two are known to remain. However, the demand was great, and England was flooded with secret Bibles. To stop the spread of the gospel was impossible at this date. The demand was too great. It's like trying to stop cocaine coming into Florida. As long as the demand is there, brother, somebody's going to bring it in. And if the money's right, you know it. Well, there was a demand for the scriptures, and it could not be stopped. Tyndale had footnotes in his New Testament. The notes were offensive to the Catholics. In the passage in 1 Thessalonians, if any man doesn't work, neither should he eat, the footnote said, a good lesson for monks and idle friars. In Exodus, where Israel danced around the golden calf, he says, the Pope's bull slayeth more than Aaron's calf. Of course, a papal bull was a papal proclamation, and usually it was an interdict on some country or something. Anyway, there was many other footnotes in there, and they went over like lead balloons.
Excuse me, Lenny. After the Bible, his Bible got to Germany, he was dead. Is this his translation?
No, he was publishing it in Germany, and he was discovered. But he was publishing an English translation, not a German one. His life was lost, I believe, in about 1536-7, somewhere around in there. And it's estimated that 50,000 copies of the New Testament were circulated before his death. But after that, it became legal shortly after that. Now, his translation was condemned and never legalized. His last words were, Lord, open the King of England's eyes. Well, that prayer was answered because in 1611, the king authorized the famous King James Bible. He actually authorized several before that. The King James Bible is highly influenced by Tyndale. 90% of 1 John is Tyndale. 5/6 of Ephesians. 70% of the New Testament is said to be Tyndale. That's how much of an impact Tyndale had. 70% of the whole New Testament is Tyndale, 5/6 of Ephesians, 90% of 1 John. Tyndale originated phrases like, blessed are the peacemakers. Then he came to himself and said, let your light so shine, for of such is the kingdom of God. Consider the lilies of the field. These are all Tyndale. Loads of the King James is Tyndale. Tyndale had love in 1 Corinthians 13. The King James went for charity. Tyndale is more literal in spots. Overall evaluation, the King James comes out a little higher, though. Following Tyndale is Coverdale, 1537. Coverdale, the purpose for Coverdale was that Tyndale was illegal. Also, the Tyndale Old Testament was never finished. Coverdale filled in with Luther's German and Swiss. Coverdale didn't know Hebrew, but he did know German, so he translated German into English, finished off the Old Testament in English, and published Tyndale's New Testament under his own name, and got it approved by the king, who had no idea he was approving Tyndale, same king. Tyndale was illegal. Coverdale was a friend of the king. Coverdale's Bible was legalized. Now remember, King Henry VIII, God used good old King Henry. King Henry had a falling out with the Catholics. Now the Catholics didn't permit divorce. And you know King Henry and how many wives he had. Well, he just didn't get along with the Catholics. And because he didn't get along with the Catholics, they had a falling out. And so, in a sense, he leaned more Protestant. Or at least took a stand against the Catholics. In any event, he and Coverdale got him to okay this translation, and the Catholics were mad, but King Henry wasn't so happy with the Catholics either. God used King Henry's immorality to aid the Reformation. In fact, King Henry ordered it put in the churches. Following Coverdale is Matthew's Bible, 1539. Matthew's is generally believed to be John Rogers. He was martyred like Tyndale. He was a friend of Tyndale. Matthew's published the rest of Tyndale's Old Testament, for Coverdale only used the Pentateuch. Matthew's published Tyndale's Pentateuch and Tyndale, Joshua to 2 Chronicles. So basically what Matthew's does is put out more of Tyndale, which was better than Coverdale, because Tyndale was a better translator. I don't know how Matthew's was martyred, because his translation was licensed by the king, but for some reason or another he ended up being martyred as well. Following Matthew's is the Great Bible, 1540. The Great Bible is again Coverdale's project. There was fear that the king might discover that he had authorized Tyndale's translation. So they decided to come out with another Bible. Cromwell was a friend of Coverdale. Cromwell was prime minister to the king. Anybody knows anything about English history, these are famous names, have tons of history behind them. Cromwell, by the way, lost his head later on. And whatever happened to dear old King Henry? Didn't he lose his head too? Died of syphilis? Oh, okay. I don't doubt it. Anyway, there was fear that the king might discover, because there were spies and Catholics and other people that were feeding the king information and trying to manipulate the king, he might discover that he'd been betrayed by Coverdale and these others, so they came up with the Great Bible in 1540. Coverdale was in charge. It was done in France. The Catholics learned about it in France. They ordered it confiscated. Coverdale learned in advance, fled to England, and finished it in England. The Great Bible is an improvement on all of the others. Now, it's still not better than Tyndale, but Tyndale's illegal, so it was an improvement on the others. It was a smoother flow. It's called the Great Bible because it was 9 inches by 15 inches, somewhat like a Young's Concordance or something like that. It's called the Great Bible. It's also called the Chained Bible because they ordered it chained to the pulpit because they had a tendency to walk out of the church. So they chained it to the pulpit. Bible reading was very popular in those days. People would just read the Bible in the pulpit and people would just come and listen. Because even though there were printed Bibles, they were still expensive for common people. Even with the printing press, they're still expensive, although they are much more available than they had been before. But people would just come to church just to hear the Bible read. And oftentimes they would be reading it at 5 in the morning. There would be somebody in there reading at 5 in the morning out loud, and children would come there and listen to it early in the morning. There was a hunger for the scriptures because it had been suppressed for so long. The next translation is in 1560, called the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible. Well, English history. The Catholics overthrew and beheaded Cromwell. England took a turn toward Catholicism. The king reversed his policies. Now, the Catholics could put enormous pressure on you by putting the interdict, what is that what they call it, the interdict on your country, which was the removal of the Mass from the laity. And then all the people thought they were going to hell, because the Catholics would withhold the Mass. And being bound by fear and superstition and pure hokum, the people would riot and clamor. And man, that put the pressure on the king. He had to kowtow to the Pope, or he was in trouble. And the king had to reverse his policy. I don't know how it came about, but that's one way that it did, oftentimes. The king issued a decree against English Bibles. Bibles were confiscated and burned. The reformers in England fled to Geneva, Switzerland. There were found Beza, John Calvin, Whittingham, Calvin's brother-in-law, Coverdale, John Knox, and many others. And while in Geneva with time on their hands, lo and behold, they decided to make a Bible translation. Need one, you know. This Bible translation was dedicated to Queen Elizabeth, Bible-loving Queen Elizabeth, who, by the way, just came right after this time. The Geneva Bible has a number of firsts. It's the first committee translation. It's the first Bible from the Hebrew and Greek complete. Complete from Hebrew and Greek. It was accurate and straightforward. It was printed in a smaller version so that it could be less expensive. It's the best translation to date. But Tyndale wasn't that bad either. I mean, there's not a whole lot of difference between the two. Geneva was used by the pilgrims who came to America. Geneva was used by Shakespeare as he quoted the Bible in his plays. Although it sounds King Jamesy, it's really Geneva, because the two are very similar. Geneva was the most popular Bible translation at the time of the King James, and the King James was not immediately popular. When the King James came out, it wasn't immediately popular. It was unpopular. Geneva was popular. Geneva is also called the Breeches Bible, for it translated Genesis 3:7, Adam and Eve sewed fig leaves together and made themselves breeches. The Geneva critics paid attention to textual criticism, but not in a major way, only in a limited way, because of the date that they found themselves in. They did list various readings, however. Following the Geneva Bible came the Bishop's Bible, 1568. The Bishop's Bible, 1568. Now, the Protestant Church was split into two groups, the Puritans and the Anglicans. The Puritans liked the Geneva Bible. The Anglicans did not like the Geneva Bible. It is said they did not like the Calvinism in the Geneva Bible, but I've read a lot of the Geneva Bible and I don't see a lot of Calvinism in it. But who's to say? The purpose of the Bishop's Bible was to produce a translation that the Anglicans would like, so they wouldn't have to read the Geneva Bible, which they did not like. The Bishop's Bible is inferior to the Geneva Bible, and it was produced by an archbishop in the Anglican Church and 15 Anglican bishops. It was not really that popular with the Anglicans either. The Bishop's Bible uses the Great Bible as its basic text. It referred to Greek and Hebrew to improve the accuracy of some passages. It also conferred with the Geneva Bible. It is said to be less accurate than the Bishop's. It is said to be unequal in that one passage is good, another passage is weak. They did not confer enough with one another to even out the translation. Queen Elizabeth refused to recognize the Bishop's Bible. It was put in the Anglican churches, and the Anglican Church held to it. This brings us up to the King James. The whole reason for the King James was to unite the Protestant Church with one translation. The Puritans read the Geneva, the Anglicans read the bishops, and the reason for the King James is they might be united and read one Bible, read the authorized King James Version. And so a huge committee was drawn together to make another translation that might unite the Protestant Church. We'll start with that next period. Questions?